Learn to code, build apps, inspire the next generation.
Welcome to the Swift App School podcast, where we are empowering the next generation of app developers.
I'm Charles Long, co-founder of Swift App School.
And I'm Bob Williams, co-founder of Swift App School. Well, welcome to episode 4 of our Swift App School podcast, the first of 2022. Happy 2022 to you, Charles.
Happy 2022. Thanks.
Yeah. So today in this episode, we're going to discuss first our holiday break. Probably that's one reason why you haven't heard from us in a while. Second will be one-on-one live mentorship platform that we discovered online. Then we're going to talk about creating full apps on the iPad, which is really exciting. Something new that Apple's released. Also, just some Apple in the news and tech company challenges out there with in terms of retention and talent acquisition. And then finally, we'll talk about something cool, as always, to end the episode. Did you have a good holiday break?
I did. I enjoyed it. It was one of the first times that I actually stayed at home and just relaxed with the family and just had a good time. Of course, the kids enjoyed it, as always. It was nice to get a few more clothes that fit and also be able to, you know, see everybody's face as they opened up their gifts. I think as a parent, that's one of the most exciting things, to see other people open their gifts that you gave them and for them to be excited about it. And so we enjoyed that, and just being able to just be at home and relax and not have to think too much about work.
Yeah. I'd say, it was nice. I didn't actually travel this year. Usually I travel to Georgia for Christmas, but didn't do that this year. So it was kind of nice to stay in North Carolina and to have my family come up here and be with them. So that was fun. Watching other people open gifts, as opposed to when I grew up, it was always about me, 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 me. What am I going to get?
Yep.
It was fun. It's nice to just chill out and not worry about work as much. So
awesome. You know, we talk about Christmas. I think as I was contemplating what we could talk about in the, you know, coding section, and just thinking about my past over the holidays, and I said, you know, I really need to talk about how I got my first computer. And I think I might have made mention of it a little bit in a prior episode, but you know, I was maybe 11 years old when I was working with my granddad at night. A couple times a week, he would clean the buildings. And so he would let me tag along. And that was really cool. There were some office buildings there. He was an engineer, or I should say he was an electrical engineer. And so the location we were at had a huge warehouse in the back, but in the front area, there were some offices. So we would, you know, take out the trash, vacuum or whatever. And there was a lady who used to work late at night, and they had a lot of Apple II computers there. And I was always drawn to a computer, just seems to be my calling. And so I saw the computers, and obviously I don't remember exactly how it worked out. Maybe we chatted, and I'm sure she found out that I was interested in computers. But of course, as I mentioned, we didn't have a lot of money, and computers were pretty expensive back then, like what, $2,000-$3,000, maybe more, depending on the computer. And, you know, I probably expressed that I was generally interested in computers at some point. And, you know, as your kid, you have that pie in the sky idea in terms of what you want for Christmas. So you just ask largely, hope it shows up. You don't have any idea, you know, you don't have any real world experience when it comes to how much things cost when you're a kid. But, you know, you just put it on your Christmas list and hope for the best. And so I guess when I was 12, maybe a year later after these conversations, I might have asked for the computer, and it was the only large gift I asked for. So I had all these smaller gifts, and so did my brothers and sisters. But then we kind of wrapped up the gifts for the day. My granddad shows up a few hours later, and he's bringing in all these trash bags. So we're like, what is this? And everybody's opening big gifts, and we're like, oh, this is cool. Christmas is going to be amazing this year. But I didn't have a large gift. So last but not least, my granddad goes back out to the car and brings in two huge Christmas bags. And I could tell there was boxes in them. So I'm like, what is this? And I remember opening the first box, and I looked down, and there was an Apple II Plus. And instantly I got a headache. I was obviously in shock because I was thinking, what? I got a computer? Because my parents were, you know, they knew it was going to happen. So they were telling me, oh, there's no way. You're not getting a computer. They cost too much money. But when I opened that box and saw it, it was just like instant shock. And it was the best Christmas ever. And I went to my room. I literally didn't even say thank you. I turned around. I walked to my room. They're like, you okay? And I just went and sat on my bed. I had an instant headache. But that was such a memorable year. And of course, you know, I got the Apple II hooked up, had a few games with it. That was really cool. It didn't take me very long, though, to break into it and open it up and see what was inside of it. And so, you know, I might have mentioned this. I was programming before off and on because we had an Apple II in my third grade class earlier, you know, in my elementary school years. But this was the second time I had access to a computer in my life, and it didn't take very long for me to dig into it or open it up and see what was inside. And obviously, you know, mm-hmm. it's been the same ever since.
Yeah, I remember the Apple II. That was my first computer as well. You know, it had those old floppy the big yeah. floppy disk, you know, the real floppy disk that no one knows what that is anymore.
Yeah, the 5 1/4.
But yeah, those were really cool. Yeah, and I mean, learning BASIC on that, it takes you back to those days, the early days of coding.
What about you? You have any like inspirational Christmas moments that you want to talk about?
I mean, I just think of the two, like, you know, game consoles. I wasn't like a huge gamer growing up, but you know, Atari definitely was the first mm-hmm. one from Christmas that I remember. You know, it had Asteroids and Pac-Man and, you know, a couple of those games like that were fun. Frogger, you know, those old timey games that I remember playing all the time. And then, you know, the other one would be the Nintendo NES, like that first that real console that I got for Christmas. I just remember like playing Zelda all the time during the holiday break and finally beating it. So yeah, I was just up all night playing Zelda. I was obsessed with Zelda. So it's funny because now it's like my kids are obsessed with the new Zelda, so on the Switch. So, you know, I mean, or they were last year anyway. But yeah, it's crazy how time flies, and you think back to those early days of games, but those were fun games.
Yeah, I remember when we got a Nintendo, like you mentioned, the NES. Mm-hmm. And what was funny is that my parents couldn't afford a color TV. So
oh yeah.
We had a black and white TV trying to play Mario. And it's like, wait, is that Mario or Luigi? It's like, it's the tall one, that's Luigi. Oh, okay. And it was funny, it took a whole nother year before I actually had a color TV and I was like, oh, those are different colors.
Well, see, we used to go to Blockbuster Video and rent the games, but then we would also rent the actual console because we didn't have a console. So we'd rent it for like a weekend. I don't know, it was like $10 or something because my dad was too cheap to buy it. So we did that for a while. And then finally, I guess we rented it so much. So it's like, all right, I guess we need to buy this. But yeah.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, those were good times. And yeah, and I mean, it's just fun to now think about that we're starting with tutorials on kind of making some of these old timey games. And some of our students are working on those now. So that's kind of cool that we're kind of coming back and coding these and going to teach kids how to code them. So
yeah, it's a great opportunity for them. And hopefully in the future, we can kind of bring those guys on and talk to them about their experience. And it's interesting as you mentioned that, because one of our TAs, he's like, I've never seen Asteroids before. Right. Because I was telling him he needed to make, you know, I wanted him to start off with the oldest games and come forward. Yeah. And he's completed Breakout, but he's like, I've never seen Asteroids before. And I was thinking, I guess you haven't. Yeah. Yeah. I guess you haven't.
Yeah.
And so,
My kids haven't either. Yeah. So do you have any New Year's resolutions? I think mine this year is going to be to code more apps in 2022, either building tutorials or just building my own apps. I just feel like I should get some more on the app store at this point in my career. So that's my goal.
I didn't make that a New Year's resolution, but it's something I have thought deeply about. if I would stop being like a squirrel, seeing acorns falling, I would be able to finish apps. So I'm not bold enough yet to say that it's my New Year's resolution, but I will start a step backwards from that, in that I keep running after different things as I see them and get excited about it, which is mastering time management. If I could do that, I feel like all of the other things would fall in line, and I would be able to finish some projects to get them on the App Store. And when we made our app together and put that up for our former job, that was awesome to have an app on the App Store, because so many people would ask that as a first question, like, do you have an app up on the App Store? Have you completed something? And so that app is no longer live. But it's like, okay, individually, we want to put our apps up because we want to have something to show for. And so when people will say, wait, you know how to develop apps? What apps do you have? Well, we used to have an app up.
Back in the day.
Yeah, I get tired of saying that. So now, you know, I understand why you want to get some things up on the store just to showcase what you can do. And we've spent more time just trying to give back and teach these camps and haven't had an opportunity to really do our own thing. But that's a great goal for 2022. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Maybe we should work on one together so we can push each other, because otherwise sometimes it's hard when you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah. I think one of the things I noticed is I have all these app ideas that I keep a log of in my OneDrive or my OneNote. And I realized as we are talking about tutorials, maybe I should take those and build those as tutorials rather than my own app, because I'm not technically interested, or really I'm not interested in making money off of them. It would be nice, but at the same time, each one is a separate business model that would take me away from what I really want to do as my mission. So I've struggled with that a lot. Like, okay, should I work on Swift App School, which won't bring me, you know, any financial gain for quite a long time unless I make a tutorial, or should I build this app and like have some money coming in on the side? And something, you know, it kind of dawned on me that, hey, why don't you use those app ideas you've generated all these years to make your actual projects for the tutorials in Swift App School? And that way you don't have to really, you can build the apps you've been thinking about, but at the same time, you can use it and drive all these different models together into one solution. So I don't know, maybe something I do. We'll have to see.
Yeah, I was thinking about the same thing with the podcast app that I started. I mentioned that earlier that I started with my daughter. She's not as interested in finishing it. And I'm kind of like, well, we've gotten so far, you know, but now I'm kind of thinking, well, maybe I just turn that into a tutorial, because it is a pretty good tutorial so far. And it's all Swift UI. So it's kind of, I think that'd be a cool one to do and finish, you know, as a tutorial maybe, but we'll see. So the other thing, as far as New Year's goes, I think I'm going to start like a daily schedule, or scheduling into my daily routine. Right now, I walk with my dog in the mornings, but doing some kind of like morning coding, maybe. I was just thinking about this the other day, because there's a book called The Artist's Way that I used to read a long time ago, but heard an interview with the author, Julia Cameron, recently. And she was talking, she's written a new book, I think, on prayers and the power of prayer. What she was talking about was just going back to the artist's way, where she talked about morning pages and just writing, like handwriting pages each morning as an exercise, just like a journal. It doesn't have to make sense, but to kind of like help your creativity. And so I was thinking it would be cool to do a morning coding or something like that. I actually heard her interviewed on the Guy Kawasaki's Remarkable People podcast that I'll talk about all the time. She was interviewed on that to start 2022. About her new book. So anyway, we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think it falls right in line with what I mentioned with me mastering time management. I have so many projects, like I mentioned, and I feel like if I could say this particular project I'm going to work on, you know, Mondays and Wednesdays or Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then I could kind of spread things out, I wouldn't look back a week later and say, I just wasted a lot of time. I didn't get anything accomplished on any of my projects because I spent too much time fretting over the fact that I didn't know which project to work on. And like, I just need to have a consistent schedule, even if it is 30 minutes to an hour, whatever it is, dedicated for working on projects. It's just time management and, you know, productivity management, but that's something everybody struggles with. And so
I mean, just looking at your day and just figuring out, okay, where do I waste the most time? Is it at night? Am I watching too much TV or whatever it is? But yeah, I mean, there's always times you can kind of go, okay, was that really worth watching that show for an hour? Like I just wasted an hour of my time. So, but I could have been coding or creating something.
Yeah, for me, it's like too much working and not enough. Like there's the work-life balance needs to be where it should be, which is I definitely have to take care of my day job first. Then I have my family. Obviously, I spend a lot of time in devotion and taking care of the inner man is very important, like you mentioned. But then there's always some time left over. We just don't like to admit that there's time. And we tend to like, okay, I think I'm just going to get on YouTube or I'm going to get on some websites. And next thing you know, there's 25 tabs open.
that's when you're supposed to use the Apple Focus app and features. So I guess next we're going to talk about the All Things Code section of the podcast. I'll let you talk about Code Mentor because you discovered that.
Yes. Yeah, so I was kind of aggregating some news and then ran across this website that existed since 2014. It's codementor.io. And it says, find a developer for live mentorship and freelance projects. And I know there's competitors out there, but this one just caught my attention that there are solutions for people that they're looking for developers and they want to make sure they can get a quality developer or get some feedback, or maybe they need to consult with a developer. I thought, okay, this is a really cool site. They've got like a code editor built in and they've got like a timer so people can charge as a mentor. And so it's given opportunity to developers to make a little extra cash. So project-based freelance work, one-on-one live mentorship, and their website has a section that shows how they work. Basically, they show you how to find a mentor. They kind of match you up with what your needs are. And then you can schedule or start a live session. So pretty cool. I thought that was a great general topic in terms of development. And then they have a section that explains how much it costs. And they're basically saying here, it's an open market where the developers can set their own rates. And it says typically a new mentor's rate can range from $8 to $15 for every 15 minutes. So there's a minimum charge of 15 minutes for each session. After the 15-minute mark, Code Mentor will charge at the mentor's rate per minute. And then there's some additional fees or whatever. So I didn't know this service existed, but now that I've looked into it, I'm sure this is not the only company doing this, but I just thought it piqued my interest.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, of course, you can go on Twitter and talk to tons of iOS developers for free. So it actually helped you a lot from what I've heard. But yeah, it is pretty nice that you do have social media platforms as well.
Right. It begs the question, is a platform like this actually lucrative for developers, or is it actually worth, you know, someone in need to look into a platform like this? I don't know. The developer community is all over the place.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, there's social networks. People are so readily available. And I'm surprised at how willing people are to just comment back or to reply back to you. And that's really been helpful for us. I mean, I don't think anyone's really blown us off at all. I think we've gotten feedback from people that we reached out to online via Twitter. So that's been
great. I mean, it helps when you go to the labs at WWDC and places like that, when you're at these conferences and you meet people in person, back when they were in person. But, you know, now, I mean, with everything online, you can meet so many people through social media, through maybe taking a tutorial online. And we're hoping to do that as well, where we can have some mentorship, especially for teenagers who are just newly starting out. And we can, you know, have a Slack channel or, you know, some other platforms where they can reach out to us. So. The next thing I wanted to mention was the new iPad Swift Playgrounds. That is amazing. I mean, I just played around with it. I've got an iPad mini, so it's a little small on my screen, but I mean, that, you know, I just started creating an app and I got pretty far with it without really needing to know too much. So, I mean, I can see how this is going to be a huge advantage for anyone who wants to start out on Swift UI, making a basic app, and just, you can start with Swift Playgrounds now and actually post it on the App Store, and it'll go through, you know, Apple Connect, iTunes Connect, or what is it called now? They keep changing the name.
I think it's App Store Connect.
App Store Connect. Yeah, it was iTunes Connect.
And Bob, for people who don't understand how significant this is, you can explain the traditional way to make apps versus what was announced. It looks like mid-December here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the appeal is really that, you know, before, I mean, like when we talk to students, it's like we have to go ahead and download Xcode ahead of time before we have any app camps, because, you know, they'd spend half their time just downloading Xcode. It's what, 10 gigs now or 11 gigs?
I think it's more than that.
More than that, but before, you know, they even have it all downloaded, and then you have to download, you know, updates to that, and it just takes so long to kind of get. And then once you open Xcode, it's just overwhelming because there's so many buttons and so many different choices. So what I like about the new Swift Playgrounds is that it just takes out all the confusion for somebody who's starting out new. It's less intimidating. You don't have things like the info.plist to really confuse you in the beginning. I mean, it's just not even there. Or if it is there, I didn't see it. And then, you know, you can just tap on like app settings. There's a little section. I'm tapping on it now on my iPad mini. You can change the name of your app. You can change the color of the icon. You can just go through the symbols, SF symbols that are built in here. And I can, you know, either create a custom icon, or I can create one with one of these symbols they give me. So it's really cool how quickly you can, you know, you're up and running with an app just with a few lines of code. So it gives you your, you know, you've got your content view that you traditionally see on Swift UI, and then you have your My App view. And those are the only two views to start out. You've got your play button, as we always said. You can run the app and see it compile.
So basically it's just taking your code, building a full-blown app rather than just like a test environment. It's actually building a full app. That you can publish to the App Store, right? From the iPad, right?
Yeah, you can publish it from your iPad, which is amazing. Now, they're also, you know, Swift Playgrounds has a lot of tutorials as well that are for real basic learners who just want to know, you know, Swift and learn some of the Swift syntax. And it has some cute little characters that'll step you through, you know, get started with coding, things like that. So those are cool too. I'd started with my daughter was like, I guess 10 or 11. I started going through some of those tutorials with her and she liked it. So I think those are beneficial when you're younger, but yeah, I mean, if, you know, if I can see us using this in an app camp in the future, and I think it'll be really nice.
I have lots of questions about this, but I won't ask them all now. I know that there were many years when we went to the WWDC conference, or I should say WWDC, or dub-dub, that a lot of developers were asking for this. I think years and years in a row, people were like, when is Xcode coming to the iPad? And I think the answer is never. I think they're taking Swift Playgrounds as a basic, simplified interface, and they're just making it better and better, which is probably a better approach because, like you mentioned, Xcode is so massive and so big and as far as size, but then also you open it up, you're going to have a whole training session just on the interface before you even jump into building any apps. I guess this approach works better for the people who have iPads, like kids who are generally interested in coding. This is pretty much just breaks the barrier for them where they can just hop in and type in code, because I guess, you know, they have to compete against other languages such as JavaScript, where the only thing they need is a text editor. And so that's going to attract a lot more people than having to download Xcode to build apps. So I think it's great for Apple to keep improving the product. And I hope to dive into it myself. I just didn't have time over the break, but I'd like to dive into it a little bit more.
And I haven't fully discovered everything about this, but I will say, I mean, just, you know, I'm just right now just tapping on the documentation. I mean, that's kind of nice to just have it so handy. You just tap documentation. And then you can scroll down and, you know, you just look up whatever you want, you know, CarKit or Swift UI or Swift or Foundation. You can learn about WatchKit, you name it, which is really cool. And, you know, then it has advanced sections. You can actually add in, I've forgotten where that is. You can add in a package manager, Swift package manager, if you want to do that. and use somebody's third party code. There's just a lot here. So even though it's basic, there's still a lot here. So it's really nice that they did that and they thought about it and stripped away the bloatedness of Xcode. It's definitely worth looking into, even if you're, you know, if you're a beginner or if you've been doing this for a long time, it's worth exploring.
I'm going to jump into Apple in the news and talk about Apple specifically, but also many of the tech companies are dealing with retention and talent acquisition right now. And I noticed over the holidays, a lot of news coming in about acquisition of employees and then Apple like trying to make sure they don't lose talent and then who they actually did lose. And not just Apple, but other companies, like I mentioned, but specifically there was an article about Apple hiring Tesla's former Autopilot software director. And so there's been rumors for quite a long time and nobody knows at what stage Apple's at, but you know, the Apple car has been predicted or rumored for quite a long time. I don't know if they're building a car or if they're just building, you know, smart car technology, who knows, but they're getting pretty serious to hire away a lot of the engineers from other companies. And that gives us the only clues or rumors that we have with what Apple's generally looking into in the future. And so why would they hire Tesla's former Autopilot software director if they weren't working on some car tech? It says they hired Christopher C.J. Moore for his team working on the self-driving car. Now, obviously, as we mentioned, this is a rumor, but you know, they hired him away. He's another former Tesla executive who joined Apple in 2020. Moore, who will be closely working on the project software, will be reporting to Stuart Bowers. And Bowers is another former Tesla executive who joined Apple in 2020. During his time at Tesla, Bowers led the company's Autopilot team. So they're definitely working on something. You know, this is no new occurrence that Apple's hiring away developers or Google's hiring away developers from other companies or Facebook. This is happening all the time. And I think it's the challenge that companies are facing when there's such, you know, talented people out there and engineers. And so Apple has this culture of secrecy, and I'm not exactly sure how they keep things under wraps. Really, things get rumored, it seems like, within months of release, but they have this culture that they're trying to uphold. And, you know, they hired away Kevin Lynch from Adobe. We remember when he was there. And that's been a great addition for Apple. I don't like it when it goes the other direction. Maybe because it's, you know, the Apple fanboy in me, but I don't like when it happens to Apple, especially when it's a pretty important position. So I don't know anything about how Apple works as far as anti-competitive or like what type of contracts they have to sign. You know, if it's someone high up, they know some things. And so I don't know how they handle that situation. All companies, I'm assuming there's some type of agreement that you have to sign that you don't talk about things even after you leave. So I'm assuming that's how they handle it. And people, I guess, are listening to that, or maybe that's how rumors get started, that they don't. You know, we talk about that. And then as far as retention, like what is Apple doing to try to keep people from leaving? Well, there was an article that says Apple pays its engineers $180,000 bonuses to stop them from joining Meta. And that's not something I want to go deep into in this episode, but the whole metaverse is sort of the future, Web 3.0. And it's so big that Apple's willing to put up some serious money to keep people from leaving. And obviously, you know, with Facebook changing their parent company name to Meta and being all in, they are going to start overlapping a lot. And this article kind of talks about Facebook's plans and Apple's plans. And basically, over the next few years, Apple and Meta are likely to face off in a range of products, such as mixed reality headsets. Facebook mentioned maybe smartwatches, and then, of course, home devices, which they already have. Apple's got the HomePod. They've got, was it Apple Home? Is that what it's called?
HomeKit.
Yeah, they have HomeKit, and they have devices that are compatible with that. Yeah. Facebook obviously has their screen, similar to Amazon has one, but Facebook has one that you can... You know, it's just got the tablet-like view on the front and it's got speakers on it or whatever. everybody's sort of overlapping in these areas and they're hiring in, you know, engineers from each other's garden. Mm-hmm. So it's getting really competitive. These companies are having to figure out how can they put incentives forth to keep people from leaving. That's one of the articles of, in terms of, you know, retention. And then the last thing is, well, is Apple losing? Yes, they are, because they just lost Jeff Wilcox. Now, Jeff Wilcox was the guy who oversaw the transition from the Intel chip to the Apple M1 processor. Mm-hmm. So for people who don't know, Apple made one of the most significant moves in my experience, which is they moved away from Intel processors to their own SoC or silicon on chip. So basically they said, hey, we've been tinkering with making our own processors since 2000. And I don't know, I know the iPad came out in 2010. At some point after that, they started developing their chips in-house instead of relying on Intel. And so they basically made their own chip. And a lot of that was just to get their feet wet in building their own processors and basically taking everything in-house. And so instead of buying four or five different chips from different companies, now Apple's making their own, similar to the iPhone and iPad, called the M1. They decided to announce that in 2020. Now we have the second version of that with the MacBook Pros and more to come in the future. But I don't know if this is a blow, because I was just reading through this article. His post on LinkedIn said, it's been an incredible ride. I could not be prouder of all we accomplished during my time there, culminating in the Apple Silicon transition from the M1, M1 Pro, M1 Max SoCs and systems. I will dearly miss all of my Apple colleagues and friends, but I'm looking forward to the next journey, which will start at the first of the year, more to come. And so now he's serving as Intel's fellow and the lead of the company's design engineering group. Mm-hmm. So he's responsible for all of the architecture that Intel is going to be doing in the future. And Apple's, you know, done a great job releasing the M1. The reviews are out. The machines are amazing. Definitely more efficient than the Intel processors. Intel's taken notice and they're not happy about it. And so I think that they are doing everything they can to try to get their number one position back. And so hiring this guy is a step in that direction. And I'll finish up with this point, saying that apparently he came from Intel and went to Apple at some point. And that's probably when they transitioned from the old processors to Intel. So maybe he was involved in that and probably wants to continue his work in the Intel line. So he decided, okay, everything's transitioned over to Apple. It's going to be Apple's silicon from now on. I'm just going to go on to back to Intel. I feel more comfortable with that. So maybe it's not a loss. Maybe this is his calling to stick with Intel. But it just goes to show that these companies are highly competitive. You know, they have the challenge of building a company and, you know, being able to acquire talent, keep talent, try not to lose and keep that step ahead of the other competitors.
Well, I think Apple was smart to move away from Intel. I mean, it just allows them to innovate so much faster now. Apple Silicon is amazing what they've already done. And I know there's probably more great things to come from Apple there. So, and it sounds like, he's just wanting to go back to Intel, and like you were saying, so I'm not sure that's a huge loss to Apple, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think, you know, looking at what Apple has done with the Apple M1 processor, I'm sure they're going to have an M2 or whatever in the future, but basically they took all of their different technologies from their security chip, their memory, their hard drives, processor, graphics, GPU, they put all that together into one. It's called an SoC, system on chip. And that technology allows them to be incredibly efficient. Mm-hmm. So what that means in English is, you know, you've had an M1 for quite a while. I think you said you haven't heard the fan kick on yet.
Yeah, I still haven't.
Crazy. I have the newer one and I haven't heard it come on yet. And so
actually, I've heard it once, and it was when it was shutting down. So when I heard it, it just, I don't know, something happened and I had to shut it down. And that was the only time I ever heard the fan. So,
yeah. So that just means it's running really, really cool most of the time. It's not a bad thing to hear your fans kick on.
Yeah.
But it just means that your computer's working extremely hard and it needs to cool itself down in order to prevent from overheating and, mm-hmm. and destroying its longevity. But the fact that the temperatures stay cool on these machines and the battery life being the other point that's great. I mean, to get 15 hours to 20 hours of battery life on these new machines. This is like double what I was getting before. It's amazing. Yeah. So it works, and the performance speaks for itself. I think Apple touted a lot of numbers in their keynotes, but then about a month later when the machines were shipped out, you know, it was actually true. Mm-hmm. And that's why Intel was pretty upset about it, because they kind of figured, oh, Apple's going to make this chip. Good luck with that. We've been doing it since the 60s or whatever. But Apple, you know, they have some pretty intelligent engineers as well, and they've learned. And then obviously, I think a lot of it is they've hired away some smart people too. So I think that's where a lot of this talent has come from. It didn't just come from within. It also came from hiring the right people and putting the right engineers in place to build a great product. So kudos to Apple for that. But they'll still have to contend with these other companies when it comes to, you know, the future of technology and going into this whole metaverse, and whether VR or which virtual reality or AR, augmented reality, is going to play a big role.
Yeah. And there was a time when I thought Apple, no, they're not making a car. They're just going to create software for, you know, for all cars. And I don't think that now. I actually think, you know, Apple's a hardware company first and foremost. So they're making some kind of car. It's just a matter of when, not if, at this point, in my mind anyway, that's going to be released. And same for the glasses. I mean, everybody knows that's coming probably this year.
Speaking of the car, you know, I have mixed emotions about it. Obviously, if Apple makes a car, I like to have one. But at the same time, they need to hire the right people. They're going to be new to this space. Even if they hired away half of Tesla's engineers to do something like this, you got to wonder, you know, version one of Apple products are typically for the early adopters. Mm-hmm. So do you want to be an early adopter on a car?
Probably not.
Oh, I don't know. And then, you know, they're going up against the likes of Ford, Chevy, Honda, Nissan, Volkswagen.
But maybe they'll have a developer giveaway, you know, just like they did with the Apple TV, remember?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'll be one car out of like millions and millions of developers.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. And, you know, I don't have to feel bad about Apple blowing $20 billion on it, because they've got way more than $20 billion as they reach the 3 million market cap. And who knows how much cash in the bank. Like, I don't think they're going to be.
$3 trillion.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Probably be at $4 trillion before too long.
Yeah, what did I say? $1 trillion? No, three. Yeah, three.
You said $3 million, $3 trillion.
Yeah, sorry. No, $3 trillion, right.
Yeah.
I don't think they have any, you know, if they want to spend $20 billion to try to do this, you know, it's not going to hurt them at all. And who knows, when it's announced, it's probably going to be more money spent than that on this kind of feat. But hopefully they'll do well with that. And it just makes the electric car market more competitive. Now, I have heard one thing is that they're partnering with some of the companies who already develop cars to do this, which is a smart thing. I don't think they need to do more of the heavy lifting. I think they need to get a company that who's building these car replicas and put their software in it. And that would be the best bet. They don't need to go as far as Tesla has gone with doing most of it in-house. I think they need to, they definitely need to make the right decision here and hire on a company that's, and I've seen some rumors, but who knows? You won't know until it happens, until it's officially announced. And finally, something cool. I believe it was back in 2003 or 2004. I think it was 2004 that we received our first home. My wife and I had been married, I guess, a year and a half, maybe 2 years. When we got our first home, we were in apartments before that. And we had a Habitat house. And the Habitat house was great for us. Very low payments, 0% interest. And we had one child at the time. So we got a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom home, 800 square feet. We were there for quite a while. So it got pretty tight at the end there. But I really like the Habitat for Humanity organization. Well, part of our story, how we were able to get to the point we are now. So very thankful for that. But I saw this article that Habitat for Humanity gave a family in Virginia their first 3D printed home. And they did this through, I guess they built it with partnership in a company called Alquist 3D. And so this company basically 3D prints the shell of the exterior of the house using the cement material. And so we can leave their web address in the show notes. But I thought this was really cool when I, you know, watched the video, but it talked about the Habitat for Humanity CEO basically expressed their interest in doing this project and partnered with the Alquist company. This particular home was a 1,200 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2 baths, and it was built from concrete. And so it's for a lady and her son, and they kind of expressed their thanks, did the ribbon cutting, and they have lots of photos on the website showcasing the 3D printed home.
That's really cool. It looks like a really nice home too.
Yeah.
Very traditional looking, even though you wouldn't spot it off the street and say, hey, that's 3D printed.
Right.
I mean, it looks like a normal home.
I think it's really cool for Habitat to, you know, go into something like this. I don't know if the Alquist company approached Habitat or if Habitat had someone there who was interested in pursuing this, but I believe this was their first partnership together and the first home that Alquist has actually 3D printed. I'm assuming from reading the article. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And there's a little bit of a story behind their receiving the home. I was just leaving the notes so you can look at that if you'd like to, but being a prior Habitat homeowner, I just thought that was really cool. I definitely like when technology is used to enhance industries out there. So that was another cool story. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Swift App School podcast.
You can always find us online at swiftappschool.com. And we're also on social media at Swift App School on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Bye, y'all.
Goodbye.